Ancient words, wise words from the book of 1 Samuel. And we're going to talk about sons, sovereigns, and significance. When you think about Samuel, a great giant, if you will, of faith, and you can't help but think about a life that from its very outset was dedicated to God. And certainly that promise his mother made, that vow his mother makes, she instilled in him in some way in those early days when she still was weaning him before she actually brought him to Eli, for Eli to care for him. You can't help but wonder the impact that that had on this young child and how he carried himself throughout his adolescence, his teenage years, into his manhood, as he was going to have to deal with some tremendously significant events, and he was going to stand before kings. He was going to face enemies and confront them with a people who were not always the most faithful lot of folks that you might find. But we have come to a point in his life in our study throughout the past several months where finally peace is achieved. If you look at chapter 7, beginning with verse 15, you see that there's been a peace achieved both with the Philistines as well as the Amorites. Verse 14 talks about the cities that the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel from Ekron to Gath, and Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines. There was peace also between Israel and the Amorites, which suggests if there's peace also between Israel and the Amorites, there's now peace between, from at least Israel's perspective, there's peace between them and these constant thorns in their flesh, these Philistines who have been plaguing them up to this point in time. And Samuel has reached a point now where he can function as a judge. He doesn't have to worry about battles any longer. He's just going to function as a judge. And it says he went on a circuit year by year to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah. And he judged Israel in all these places. And then he returned to Ramah, for his home was there. And there also he judged Israel. And he built an altar there to the Lord. Some have likened Samuel to Jesus in the fact that Samuel served as a prophet and a priest, and a judge. Jesus served as prophet, priest, and king, although his priesthood really didn't begin until he ascended to the right hand of the Father. But there were those similarities between these two individuals. Things appear at this stage, as we end chapter 7, to have progressed rather nicely for Israel from their conquering the Philistines in chapter 7. And peace being a part of the equation. And as Samuel would ride his circuit every year and then do the remainder of his judging from his home in Ramah. We don't have any idea of knowing exactly how many years transpire between the end of chapter 7 and the beginning of chapter 8. The writer simply tells us at the beginning of chapter 8, Samuel has become old. As his work, he's done year after year, however many years that was. He's finally decided, I can't do this anymore. And I'm going to pass the mantle on to my sons. I don't know about you, but up until this point in time, have we heard anything about a marriage or a family? We really haven't. We're introduced to his family here in this circumstance. In chapter 8, verses 1 and 2, it says, when Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second, and you can find this in 1 Samuel chapter 8, again, verse 1 and 2, the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. Think about this for a moment. He names these boys. And you know, we think of Joel, we have Joels today, so we may not understand the significance of that name in a Hebrew culture. But the name Joel or Joel means Jehovah is God. Samuel's not forgotten, even in with respect to his family, who he is and what he's been dedicated to, what his purpose is. He names his sons Jehovah is God, and Abijah means my father is Yah, or my father is Jehovah. The sad part about all of this is that's rather ironic when you read the next verse. Because while that may have been how Samuel felt, that feeling wasn't shared by his sons. And so let's look at this idea of sons for a moment. We've already discussed the relationship between Eli and his sons Hophni and Phinehas earlier in this book. But I want to go back to refresh our memories for just a moment and look at chapter 2 and verse 22. Eli's very old. There's a parallel here, and I believe there's a parallel for a purpose. Eli's sons were very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all Israel and how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of meeting. So here you had a godly man, a man who was attempting at least. Eli certainly had his problems where we're not really told about Samuel having any of these kinds of difficulties that Eli would have had if you read through the story and remember the story. Samuel seems to be a giant, a spiritual giant. Eli lacked. The only thing enormous about Eli would have been his size, perhaps. Samuel, on the other hand, is a man of great, tremendous faith. But there's something about their sons. While Eli and Samuel may be different, their sons are somewhat similar. Not to the exact way in which they dishonor the Creator, but they dishonor Him, both sets of sons, nonetheless. We're told a little bit more about Eli's sons and the reason for their behavior than we are why Samuel's sons behave the way that they do. And we'll look at verse 3 in just a moment. But God said to Eli, you did not restrain your sons. I don't know. You might assume that was as they were growing up. You may assume that was in their role as priests. Maybe it's both of those circumstances. That the reason that they became wicked as men was because they were never restrained as children. And then, well, how do you rein them in as grown men doing the kind of things that they're doing? But he didn't stop them then either. Yes, he kind of chastises them in verse 23 of chapter 2. Why do you do these things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all these people. But he didn't stand up and stop it. But when we come to Samuel and his children, at least the two that are named here that he passes on the mantle of judge to, we're not given an explanation. We're told what their behavior is in this particular text. But what we find is these two do not live up to those names that their father has given them. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. And you might say, well, that's not as bad as laying with the women. Are we going to begin to dissect sin and begin to suggest that one sin is more dishonoring to God than another sin? Yes, I know there are times when God says something is an abomination to Him, but sin in general separates regardless of how horrific we might find a given sin over another sin. These men perverted justice, took bribes, turned aside after gain. They did not walk in the ways of their father. How did this happen? Well, interestingly enough, contextually, we don't have any idea. Samuel is not rebuked by God as Eli was. God does not say, Samuel, you rode that circuit year after year, neglecting your responsibilities. God doesn't say that. It's interesting that when people read this, sometimes that's the conclusion they come to. Commentators may come to that conclusion as well. I was really disappointed in the lack, and maybe it just speaks to the fact that there's nothing there to make any conjecture regarding the reason why God doesn't deal with this. I would like to suggest he doesn't deal with it because of what happens next, which is really the bigger picture. But I don't believe Samuel's at fault. God's not afraid to point out the faults of his faithful followers. The man after God's own heart, David himself, we see his foibles and his faults, his failings. We see Moses' failings. He doesn't even get to enter the promised land to which he was leading this whole nation of people. We're not pointed out to any, at least in this instance with regard to his sons, any reasons as to why they may have chosen the path that they did that was different than their father's. I believe that there's a contrast here. He mentions these two men, Eli and Samuel, and he mentions their sons. He mentions how the directions their sons go. On the one hand, Eli's chastised. On the other, Samuel's not. I can't help but think there's a reason for all of that. Unfortunately, I cannot give you definitively what that reason may be. I'll suggest something at the end. But what I do want you to understand, what I think each of us needs to understand, young or old, whether Samuel is responsible or not, we must understand that there's a steep price that's going to be paid, not only with respect to Samuel's sons, but to an entire nation of people because of what they are choosing to do at this particular point in time. And maybe it's just they're in the right place at the right time to be used as a reason for the people to reject God and to choose a king. And that's where this idea of sovereigns comes in. The people are clamoring now for a sovereign. They want a king. They are fed up with this idea of judge. We don't want judges like the judges we've had. We don't want men serving in our temple like Eli's sons. We don't want judges like your son Samuel. We want a king, and we want a king like the nations around us. That's the point that they make. If you look at their demand in verses 4 and 5 of 1 Samuel chapter 8, I tried to find a way to keep it from doing this, and I couldn't. So as it's scrolling to its place, you be turning to that same place in your Bible if you're not already there, because the only place we're going to go from 1 Samuel, as I'll tell you now, we're going to go to Romans at the end. But otherwise, we're staying in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. So here come leaders from all over Israel. And they come to talk to Samuel at his home. And they said to him, "Behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways." Your sons don't behave like you. They don't make decisions like you make. And we're fed up. We're tired of it. Appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. They've forgotten that they've had a sovereign. A sovereign who has done incredible things for them. A sovereign who is unlike any other sovereign. But we'll talk more about that in a minute. You put yourself in Samuel's shoes for a minute. You decided that it's time for you to pass the mantle on. Your sons have started that work, but they're not upright individuals. They're not faithful in their service, neither to you nor to their God. The people are upset, and the people come and they say, "Hey, we've had enough. Your sons are just not being righteous. And so we want a king. Samuel is a man who's dedicated his whole life to his God and to the teaching of his God and to the furthering of the judgment of God to his people so that they would know how to walk in the ways of God. And now these people are coming to him and saying, "We're not happy with any of this." What's your tendency? Take the log out of your eye before you get the speck out of your brother's eye. Clean up your own house before you come to clean up my house. I can imagine a number of those kinds of things coming to our minds they're charging my own sons. I think Samuel knew that. I think Samuel already understood how his sons were behaving. And I can't help but think that he's suffering from a broken heart. But that's not in the text. That's Keith. But I do know what he does. And he doesn't respond like I might have responded or how others might respond. Notice what he does in verse 6. In verse 6, he says, "But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.' And Samuel prayed to the Lord." Samuel saw a bigger picture here. Were his sons a difficulty? Yes. Would he deal with his sons? I imagine that he does at some point. Again, we don't know contextually. What we do know is that he saw that this was a much bigger problem than just his sons, because now a whole nation of people are wanting to reject the sovereignty of God for a king like the nations and the people around them. Give us a king to judge us. But even in that, he doesn't lash out. He doesn't lash back. What does he do? He does what men of God always have done when they have been behaving faithfully to their God. Samuel prayed to the Lord. How many times have we referenced in our Old Testament studies that godly men would always inquire of the Lord, seek the Lord? They would pray to the Lord as Samuel does here. And that's what he does. And I would urge us to be people who, rather than lash back out at accusations and charges, we'd be people who would first inquire of the Lord. We would be people who would first pray to God to help us. I'm not sure all that Samuel says in this prayer, because we go from Samuel's prayer to Jehovah's response immediately, according to the writer, in verses 7 through 9 of this particular text. It says, "And the Lord said to Samuel." So whatever Samuel says in his prayer, here is how the Lord responds. "Obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you." In other words, if I were to put it in our vernacular, give them what they want. Give the people what they want. "For they have not rejected you." And this is interesting, because you'll note how this ends in just a moment. But the Lord begins by saying, "But they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them." So they've had a sovereign. God has recognized his right to rule these people. He has been their king. But they're clamoring for another, and he says, "Give them what they want. According to all the deeds that they have done from the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods." Now remember, he's already said, "They've not rejected you, they've rejected me." But he finishes by saying, "They've rejected you too. So they are also doing to you." But the focus isn't you, Samuel, the focus is me. They're rejecting me. They're rejecting the sovereign who's delivered them out of Egypt. And all along, since that delivery, these people have been up and down and up and down and up and down. They've forsaken me and served other gods. with tremendous regularity. But Samuel, you give them what they want. Obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you. Verse 9, now then obey their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. So again, he reiterates, give them what they want. But let them know what to expect with regards to what they're going to get. Show them, solemnly warn them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. And what we find is that Samuel again obeys. Samuel is consistent in his life as one who is obedient to his God, even when it is not pleasant, when it is not comfortable, when it would have been much easier for him just to go on a rant against these folks. God says, give them what they want, but let them know what to expect with regard to what they're going to get. And Samuel obeys. And that's what verses 10 through 18 of this particular text. And some of these things the king would do are harsh. They're probably true of any ruler of any place. You have very few benevolent kings throughout history. Even our own government is full of taxation and corrupt situations and circumstances. Democracies, as good as they are still not the sovereign rule of God over His people. God is the only sovereign who is also one who would be considered a benefactor. He's a benevolent king. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king from him. He said, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants. He will take your male servants and your female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. And he will take the tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. And maybe the saddest words in this whole reading. That's how is how Samuel closes this section. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. If you were on the receiving end of that kind of warning, how would you respond? What would you do? Well, it's apparent that the group who was listening to this did that. What Scripture calls they stopped up their ears. Oh, they may have heard the words. They may have heard the audible words being spoken, but they weren't paying attention to anything that was being said. I think God is saying to them, here's your last chance. Go ahead, Samuel, give them what they want, but tell them, warn them. And if they repent, God's going to say, okay, now you're talking. Now we can get back to business of my ruling, my people. But notice their response, because they simply resolve that, no, we want a king like the nations around us. We're not going to have it any other way. But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but there shall be a king over us that we also may be like the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. What a danger we all face. And, you know, to emulate the world in which we live, it obviously is not a new dilemma. That's exactly what these people are exploring. We want to be like these people all around us. We want a king just like all of these other nations. We're tired of being different. What would it possess them to think that a king would be any less subject to corruption and bribery and misjudgment and immorality than any of their judges had been if he's a king like the nations all around them? They had a king who was above all of that. They're rejecting him. In spite of the warnings, in spite of everything that Samuel says, they refuse to obey the voice of Samuel, and they say, no, we want our king because we want to be like everybody else. And we all said that at one time or another in our lives, haven't we? Younger or older, doesn't make any difference. I can remember saying to my parents on a number of occasions, when I wanted to do something or wanted to buy something, they would give me, you know, they would tell me no, and they would give me whatever that was their reason was, and I would say, but everybody else is doing it. What's that? I want to be like the nations. There's no difference. This problem is a problem that's universal. It existed then, it exists today. Well, look at how Samuel ends chapter 8, or the writer ends chapter 8. When Samuel heard all the words of the people, he repeats them in the ears of the Lord. And so again, we find him talking to God, inquiring of God, seeking God in this manner. And the Lord said to Samuel, obey their voice and make them a king. Then Samuel said to the men of Israel, go home. I don't know if there's any, the only sadder words were the Lord would not hear them. These words run a close second. Go home. Go to your city. You'll get what you want. Well, and Samuel, can you think about this one, dedicated to God throughout his whole life, how much disappointment he experienced in his life, and yet never lost sight of who was most important, who needed to be praised, and who needed to be pleased in all of this. It was the God to whom he was dedicated. And I believe at some point that dedication transferred from his mother's vow, his mother's promise, to this is my God now. And this is my own dedication. Because quite honestly, it's difficult to do the kinds of things this man does based on the conviction of somebody else. Even a parent. While that will get me so far, it won't get me as far as Samuel goes. Samuel is dedicated to his God. And that's seen in all of these things we've talked about. And he tells the people, go home. So what do we learn from this? What's the significance of this text? Well, if we don't take anything else away from the father-child circumstance with regard to Hophni and Phinehas and Eli and Joel and Abijah and Samuel. I think in Samuel's case, in Eli's case, there's no question. Some of the actions of the sons, while they are held accountable themselves for their actions, Eli bears some of the fault. God tells us he bears some of the fault. In the case of Samuel and his sons, we don't hear God saying Samuel bears some of the fault for the decisions of the Son. And what that simply means is there can be good, godly, dedicated, spiritually minded adults who live faithfully before their God, whose children will not emulate that faith. For whatever reason, they just choose not to do that. Faithfulness on the part of the parent does not always result in faithfulness on the part of the child. Sometimes we're at fault, sometimes we're not. But not only is that a lesson we might learn from this, I think a lesson we undoubtedly learn without question is that consequences of the actions of the sons went far beyond the sons. This whole nation of people now come to Samuel with an outcry, we're done. We want a king. And again, it may be that this was just a convenient excuse, but sometimes I can give somebody an excuse to do something that they were going to do anyway. They just need to find the right situation and the right circumstance, but I don't want that circumstance to be me. I guarantee you, you don't want it to be you. And ultimately, I doubt that Joel and Abijah are really thrilled with the choices that they made now. Consequences may be catastrophic and affect far beyond you and your immediate circumstance or your immediate family. But above everything else, you need to go to Romans chapter 1 with me here. God, we need to be careful what we ask for. You've heard that saying, haven't you? Be careful what you ask for. Well, why? Well, because God sometimes will give you what you want. Look at Romans chapter 1, beginning with verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. So in other words, God has made Himself apparent to every human being just by virtue of His creation. It's amazing to me how somebody can look at this and say it's all an accident. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. This cannot be the result of accident. It shows design, it shows intellect, it shows wisdom, it shows creativity. Accident doesn't do that. Accident leaves things in catastrophic circumstances. Things become marred, they become destroyed with respect to accident. God says, I've shown you who I am. I've shown you that I exist. For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. And He says, so we are without excuse. I'm without excuse. You're without excuse. Joel and Abijah were without excuse. Hophni and Phinehas were without excuse. Eli was. There's no one who can say, I really didn't grasp the significance of who you are. If you've looked at the creation at all, you are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, because they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Here's the key. Therefore, God gave them up. God said, okay, go ahead. You get what you want. God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity. If this is what you want, go ahead, take it. Do it. I'm not going to force you to be otherwise. I'm not going to force you to do otherwise. You know who I am by virtue of everything that you see. And if in spite of that you choose these kinds of things, I'll give that over, give you over to them. I'm going to let you have them. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God, yes, second time, he's reinforcing this reality that we'll get what we want. We'll get what we ask for. God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another. Men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. Whoops. Should be one more verse there. So it's kind of left you hanging with a thought there. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, what do we have in verse 28? And God gave them up. God gave them what they wanted. If they wanted to do debased things, God allowed them to do it. He gave them up to a debased mind, to do what ought not to be done. We want a king. We want a king to be just like the nations around us. That troubled Samuel. It troubled God. God gave them one more chance. Tell them, Samuel. Warn them. Warn them about this king. He did. They said, no. We want a king. God said, give them what they want. Obey their voice. I hope we'll learn to obey the voice of God rather than the pull of our culture, rather than some sensual feelings that we have that we want to gratify in some way or another beyond that which God, the parameters within which God has placed us to be able to satisfy those sensual urgings. Hophni and Phinehas and their sin, and Joel and Abijah and their sin, tremendous consequences beyond the scope of their own personal lives. But the two men who fathered them are distinctly different. Eli was at fault. Samuel, no fault is laid at his feet for the decision of his sons. May he have been? Well, again, that's just as much conjecture, I guess, as my saying, there was no fault. There's no fault stated. You're going to have to at least grant me that. There's no fault stated in the text, here or elsewhere, with respect to Samuel and his sons. But may we react like Samuel in circumstances that we might find ourselves in when our children do not exhibit the qualities that we would hope they would. That we might have taught them, would have taught them. I believe Samuel would have been just as dedicated to his sons as his mother had been to him. And may we be like Samuel. Faithful in every way, responsive to the voice of God, even when we are in pain, we have been brought to a point of deep displeasure over what's happening all around us. We are dismayed by the circumstance. May we understand that God is in control and that they have not rejected us, but they have rejected God. And may we be responsive to the voice of God, regardless of the circumstance.